I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. There's a really engaging book soon to be published, Happy City, Transforming Our Lives Through Urban Design. Its author, the journalist and urban experimentalist Charles Montgomery, joins me now to share some of the ideas in the book taken from his many travels and experiences around the world. That cities are now where most of us live is without question. We're there. How then do we have better cities, especially happy ones? That's Mr. Montgomery's quest, and what he's found through his interviews with scientists, urban planners, economists, politicians, activists, and others is fascinating stuff. The shape and system of cities are key to what makes us happy. How we move, where we live, and how we interact with one another are all part of the path to happiness. I'll get Mr. Montgomery to share with us what is in this book. He's based from here in Vancouver, and his writing has appeared in many magazines and journals worldwide. His first book, The Last Heathen, won the Charles Taylor Prize, among other awards. He was an original team member of the BMW Guggenheim Lab, and he produces programs at the Museum of Vancouver. Visit the websites charlesmontgomery.ca and thehappycity.com for more. The book is published by Doubleday. Please welcome to the Platt Online program in Toronto today, Charles Montgomery. Mr. Montgomery, good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I mentioned that you were a member of the BMW Guggenheim Lab. For people that don't know what that is, what exactly did you do there?
Well, the lab was an experimental project, really. The Guggenheim Museum invited people from various disciplines from around the world to come to New York City and create a pop-up laboratory space for 3 months in the city. And so I worked with a small team, there were only four or five of us, to turn this empty, what was essentially an empty yard in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, into part laboratory, part meeting space, part exhibition space, and part think tank, where we tried to understand the city better and come up with new ways of making a more comfortable, happy city.
And is that some of the work that you do, too, here at the Museum of Vancouver?
Somewhat. The Museum of Vancouver has a mandate to very aggressively challenge people in Vancouver to see their past, present, and future differently. So what we do there with some of our public programs is to treat the city as a laboratory, to give people a chance to get their hands dirty and experiment with the city, essentially.
And I guess they'll be doing some of that at this event on the 23rd of November.
That's true.
The museum. I guess it's sold out now. I'm not supposed to mention that, right?
You know, you can mention it because while the book launch in the evening is sold out, in fact, there's a daytime program where we've invited students from design institutions through the Lower Mainland to come up with new designs for happiness. And essentially that means designs that can nudge people, nudge strangers together to trust each other more, to feel good together more. And there's still space to attend that daytime program in the afternoon of November 23rd.
And
called
so
the Happy City Machine.
So people can go to thehappycity.com for information on that, right?
Yes.
Did you grow up in Vancouver?
I was born in Vancouver, but actually I grew up in Duncan on Vancouver Island. I was a farm boy in my teen years.
Yeah, so I went to your Twitter page, and it says that you live in Vancouver, Toronto, New York, and Mexico City. Is that correct?
Those are the places where I seem to spend lots of time.
I
live in East Vancouver,
yeah.
Otherwise known as Paradise,
uh-huh.
And my partner's from Mexico City, so we spend a lot of time in Mexico City with his family as well.
Now, I guess you live on the drive, is that right?
Yeah, just off the drive.
Yeah. See, I live at Fraser and King Edward, and whenever I talk to people who are from Vancouver or who live here, wherever they live seems to be the best place. Ever, right? I mean, you talk to people from Kitts, they say the same thing. People in Carisdale, people in Yaletown, I mean, they think that it's the best place ever. So I'm assuming that Vancouver is a happy city, is it?
Well, look, I think we do pretty well in many ways. And in terms of design, Vancouver is doing very well. But if you compare Vancouver to other Canadian cities, we actually score lower than most other major Canadian cities on both self-reported happiness, but as an ingredient to that, we score lower for trust. We trust our neighbors and strangers in the city much less than people in mid-sized Canadian cities.
So how do you measure happiness? I mean, you just mentioned that we score low than other Canadian cities. So what are the, say, the factors that make people happy?
Well, I guess we should back off a little bit, and I should explain to you why anybody should accept a rating of happiness of a person or a place. So, you know, we've been trying to figure this question, you know, what are the ingredients of happiness, out for thousands of years. Even the ancient Greeks looked into that question. And, you know, we've had the toughest time coming up with an empirical measurement of whether someone is happy or not, or what the ingredients are. But in the last 20 or 30 years, through advances in neuroscience and through new techniques in psychology and even surveying and with behavioral economics, we're starting to get a bit of a map. And this all began really when neuroscientists realized that if you pop someone into an MRI machine to watch their brain activity, people who say they're feeling happy actually have more activity in the pleasure centers of their brain than people who say they're not happy. And through this and other measures, we realize, oh, a really good way to measure if someone's happy or not is just to ask them. And we tend to be fairly accurate in our own assessments. So, look, we take that information, and then economists will survey thousands or now hundreds of thousands of people, and you start to be able to correlate those answers. So the question is, you know, how happy would you say you are on a scale of 1 to 10? And then you can correlate those answers with national stats on suicide rates, on mental health, and on other environmental and public health factors.
So
you asked about ingredients.
Yeah.
Well, in some ways, we're still divining those when it comes to cities. So you can create a general recipe for the soup of human happiness. And that would be things we all know, actually. We know it's better to be rich than to be poor. That's absolutely true. We know it's good to feel safe. It's good to feel healthy. And in fact, it's more important to feel healthy than to be healthy. It's how you feel that matters most. It's important to have a sense of meaning in our lives and to feel capable that we can get through every day without going through hell. And most importantly, I should say, and the factor that joins all of those together, is that it's important to have strong, positive social relationships.
And so we'll talk about some of the tips that you have in terms of achieving, say, happiness in an urban center. But the idea of happiness varies from person to person. And mm-hmm. even for myself, let's say I want to have a big fat sandwich for lunch. I think that'll make me happy, but probably an hour and a half afterwards I'm going to feel sick and probably not be as happy. To go back to what exactly happiness is, you talk to a lot of psychologists and neuroscientists about that. What happens up in the head, in the brain, with regards to what it is that makes us happy?
Well, it's funny you mentioned, you know, the big sandwich. Why don't we throw a chocolate bar inside the sandwich and some bacon as well and really enjoy that sandwich?
Sounds pretty good, yeah.
And see if having one of those a day for 20 years, see how that works out for us. What the behavioral economists are finding is that we're actually not that good at what economists call maximizing utility. In other words, we're not that good at making the decisions in modern society that lead to our long-term happiness. And, well, some economists tried to boil this down to an equation even recently. The Nobel Prize-winning economist Gary Becker, he called it the evolutionary happiness function. And it's a very complex, almost indecipherable, but its basic message is this. We are hardwired to want more stuff. And when we get more stuff, we get used to it really quickly. And then guess what? We start wanting more stuff again. And so it's as though the finish line is always receding. The key message to be drawn from that is that if you judge your happiness by getting stuff, you'll never actually get there. But if you judge your happiness through experiences, the nice thing is that we never actually get used to or grow accustomed to nice experiences. They keep being nice all the time, forever. So how does that relate to cities? That's a big question. Yeah. And the question is, do our cities enable us to have more positive experiences, especially interactions with other people, or not?
And so when, as you said earlier, Vancouver scores low on the happiness scale, if you will, what do you think we need to do here? I mean, we do have bike lanes, and you're well aware of the consternation that causes a lot of people, usually open mouths on radio and the sort. I mean, that's an experiment that the current government here has engaged in. And has it worked?
Well, I think it's important to see ourselves on the space-time continuum. So I understand where experiments, redesigns of urban streets can cause great consternation in the moment, particularly amongst drivers who say, oh my God, this is creating more traffic. But in the long run, here are a couple of things we understand about cities. In traffic congestion is a given in a thriving city. In fact, if you don't have traffic congestion, you're probably not a thriving city. And that efforts to build more capacity for motor vehicles usually fall flat because within 4 or 5 years, those lanes fill up again. It's called induced demand.
Yeah.
So in the city of Vancouver, this project of attempting to make it safe to move in different ways, I think in the long run will pay off for happiness as some people change their habits and decide to move differently. Now, hey, let me tell you about changing habits. We think we're free actors in the city, but we're actually not. Well, I mean, we're free to choose how to react to the city, but it seems that urban design actually shapes our behavior. So, for example, in, I think, North Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina, they built a light rail line through a few neighborhoods, and within a year, people within several blocks of that light rail line had lost 5 pounds. Now, these are people who were happy driving before,
Yeah. But
they just switched their behavior. And so suddenly they were walking a few minutes to this light rail line and taking that. So it's through studies like this that we realize, or actually particularly in the States, researchers have found that they can actually predict how much you will weigh by where you live in the city. Because some neighborhoods just don't enable us to get around by foot or by bike, for example, or even walk to transit.
So people that live in suburban areas, they're probably heavier set than people that live in urban areas?
The distinction is not necessarily between suburban and urban, because you can have a very dense area that just isn't well served by transit. You know, I'm sitting in Toronto right now looking out at the skyline, and Toronto has this terrible blemish, actually, of what I call dense sprawl. So in the distance, there are these residential towers kind of lost out amid the freeways. So you walk downstairs in one of those residential towers, you can't walk to a store, you can't walk to transit, you're stranded again, completely dependent on a car. So one nice thing that's happening in cities throughout North America is that some suburbs are being retrofit in order to provide suburban residents with some of the benefits of more dense city living. That's happening in Surrey right now, where Surrey attempts to build more of a mixed-use downtown.
You write in the book about the value of talking to strangers. It's something that one has to work at. But, I mean, the benefits are clear, whether we've read your book or not. So how does one do it better in terms of engaging the people that we run into that we don't necessarily know on the street, on the bus, in the elevator even?
Yeah, it's funny. I have a bit of an ongoing argument with John Halliwell, who's an economist at UBC and probably one of the world's preeminent happiness economists. And he suggests this, that, you know, we just need to try harder and we just need to make an effort and turn your, as you say, your building elevator into a conversational landscape. But I'm skeptical about these methods. You know, we're not all so friendly. We are often, some of us are reserved. And I'll tell you something. I know a fellow in Vancouver, actually. I write about him in the book, who lived in one of those beautiful towers in downtown Vancouver. And after a while living there, he realized he didn't know a single person in his building. But he looked down on the third store atrium of the building where I think 10 or 11 residents of townhouses shared a garden. And he saw they were always out there having, you know, cocktail parties and playing volleyball in this rooftop garden. So he decided to move down to that level where he could have a little bit more control over who he interacted with. And within months, he had made friends with all his neighbors. And this plays out all over the city. In fact, you know, the Vancouver Foundation did a study, and it showed that people living in towers in downtown Vancouver are much less likely to trust their neighbors and do favors for them than people who live on the ground. So you say, what can an individual do? Well, I would think you may want to think twice about living up in a residential tower unless you're very outgoing, just as you would want to think twice about living on the deepest suburban edge, because they're both provide difficult environments for casual encounters.
In terms of architecture and how buildings are configured even, what have you found works and doesn't work in terms of fostering communities that you think are good? I mean, do pretty buildings make us feel better?
Well, that's a good question, you know. On the one hand, I'm going to go with that for a second, and then I'll play my own devil's advocate. On the one hand, neuroscientists are beginning to learn that everything in our environment acts in a symbolic way on us. So one neuroscientist, when I wanted to discuss with him, you know, how we can create happier, more friendly streets, he took me to his favorite friendly street in Southern California, and it was, of course, Main Street USA, the entrance to Disneyland. And while that may not seem like everybody's paradise, the architecture on that particular street plays all these tricks on the human mind. So the buildings are 5/8 scale. Everything looks old-fashioned, soft edges, no cars on the streets. And what he suggested is that an environment like this sends your brain messages, and it reminds you of a past, maybe even an imagined past, where things were softer, easier, and more friendly. And that this actually causes you to be more receptive to trusting social signals. So he had me walk around the streets of Main Street USA, hugging strangers, for example, and it was a very bizarre but ultimately fun day.
Yeah, you seem to have a lot of fun, or in the course of writing this book and in the different places that you've been, and sort of interesting experiences that I guess highlight the strive for happiness that we all have wherever we are in this world of ours. It seems like a fun experience. Was it for you?
It has been. I think what's happened to me is the same thing that's happened to many other people who pursue these questions. At first you might be interested from a kind of an academic or a journalistic point of view, and then you realize what you're pursuing is a change in your own life, a new way to live and to see the city. And I think the exciting thing that's happened to me is I realized I may not be a research psychologist, but I have a right to conduct experiments in the city, informal ones, just as anyone else does. And I've started to do it, and it's a ton of fun, whether it's, you know, bumping into people at Disneyland or getting together with friends and, you know, performing little street interventions in Vancouver. You know, just this weekend, when we had our opening at the Guggenheim Museum in New York, we conducted the experiments on the guests of the book launch. For example, we encouraged people to have their pictures taken with total strangers and act as though they were old friends. So people thought this was strange and weird, but they did it. You know, several dozen people did it. But then at the end of that, we surveyed them. We said to them, if you're walking home tonight, and you lose your wallet, and someone else, some stranger finds it, what are the chances you'll get it back? Well, as it turned out, people who spent a few minutes getting close and personal with a stranger, getting their picture taken at this event, were much more likely to believe they'd get their wallet back. What it tells us is that even the smallest moments of trusting, warm-hearted exchanges cause us to change our opinion of everyone else in the entire city. I think it's amazing.
Yeah. Now, on one topic that you talk about in the book that I find interesting, because I'm a transit user here in Vancouver, is sort of the idea of how transit is valued from city to city. It seems to me that political will seems to be the great barrier to more expenditure for public transit infrastructure and the sort. When a government acts the way they do with regards to spending less, do you think that they're reflecting where the people are? And so how do you overcome that in terms of building that rail line in North Carolina that you were talking about, in essentially changing people's lives that way?
Yeah, I think you've hit on a tremendous problem, and perhaps one of the greatest problems, other than affordability, that we're experiencing in Metro Vancouver. And, you know, one can blame the politicians, but I actually think the problem exists in all of us, and it comes back to that... To these cognitive errors that we all live with. We all make mistakes when choosing happiness. And unfortunately, the average human, just like the average politician, it tends to choose short-term gain over long-term benefits. So, you know, you eat that, your hamburger?
The big fat sandwich, the chocolate bar inside.
The big fat sandwich with maybe some chocolate and bacon inside. Feels great now, but not great in the future. Unfortunately, with our political term limits, you know, politicians need to get elected over the next 3 years municipally, and I don't think it necessarily leads them to push for better long-term investments. The truth is if we want a great world-class transit system, we're going to have to pay for it, and that costs tax money. What that means for you and me is we're going to have to pay more property tax, or we're going to have to pay tolls when we cross our bridges. I think the great problem in Metro Vancouver, you know, to bring it down to micro level, is that our governance structure around TransLink is just a complete mess. So the province has essentially taken most power away from municipal mayors, and the province doesn't seem to be motivated to solve these problems in a meaningful way, especially if it means more tax.
You mentioned something in your answer to the last question that I haven't touched on, and that's affordability. I guess that's a problem throughout the continent, throughout the world. How do you address that? And, I mean, does affordable housing automatically mean greater happiness in the context of your book?
Well, I mean, it certainly does for the people living in it.
Yeah.
I think the...
But then you also have to think about the people around, too, don't you?
Well, certainly. We are in a crisis moment in the city of Vancouver, and I think many people saw it when the city attempted to pass or move through various neighborhood planning processes that called for tremendous new amounts of density. So, on the one hand, we live in this beautiful city that is now attracting capital from around the world. But on the other hand, there is this, we have this fear of change. And some people suggest that, you know, we're not going to be able to, people like me, I'm just a journalist, you know, we're not going to be able to afford to live here in the future if we don't create a massive new housing supply. I'm actually not sure if supply alone will solve this problem, given the amount of foreign capital that apparently seems to be sitting in condos in Vancouver. I think we need to pursue other mechanisms to provide affordable housing. You know, Vancouver is doing it in some ways. I think providing laneway housing, you know, giving homeowners permission to build a cottage in their laneway instead of the garage is a good idea. But we need to go further. We need to explore new and different forms of home ownership. We need to look back into these co-op models. And perhaps we need to, create domestic, create forms of housing that may not be so attractive to the international investor. And that may look like a unit that's... that sits above industrial uses, or a unit with different rules around tenure, so it may be more difficult to sell it at market rate. I'm not sure, but we've got to pursue them, because in the end we have to ask ourselves, who is the city for?
Yeah, it's a vital question that we encounter throughout this book. I mentioned earlier that you live in Vancouver, you also live in Mexico City, Toronto, New York, you spend a lot of time there. What keeps you in Vancouver?
Well, you know, it's people, essentially, but let me tell you about the design that has led me to my relationship with people in Vancouver. So, you know, back when the one of the first housing bubbles, about 8 years ago, I was desperate to get into the market. And I realized I couldn't do it. There was no way. I was going to have to move to the very urban edge. But then a friend had bought a house just off Commercial Drive on a nice little street called Rose Street. And she invited me to buy half of her house. I couldn't afford even that, so I bought a third of it. We lifted it up and added more rooms and realized we couldn't afford to live there anymore without inviting more people to live with us. And so essentially I had followed this evolutionary happiness function. I wanted more, and then suddenly when I got it, I was paying for it. But the happy ending is that I'm in my 40s. I never thought I would be living in this communal environment at this age, and yet here we are, you know, living with six people in our house now, and my life has gotten so much easier.
Huh.
So I should say two of our roommates have left and have been replaced by twin baby boys. So there are two couples in the house and two kids. And the adults, we all take turns cooking, and we share meals when we feel like it. So that's gotten easier. We're a five-minute walk away from transit, so I walk through the neighborhood to get my groceries. I love it because I feel as though I'm constantly having these kind of superficial interactions with strangers that are so easy and warm-hearted. And I'm not the kind of guy who would normally make friends with my neighbors, but now I seem to know them all. And it just feels like home.
So you're generally hopeful about the planet, are you?
No. What a question. Well, here's... I'm not sure, but here's what I do know, is that efforts to save the world by making us feel guilty or by forcing us to sacrifice pleasure or our own well-being haven't worked. And so what I try to argue in Happy City is that if we make changes in our own lives that value experience and other people more than stuff, and if we understand the effect that urban systems have on us, we can actually build lives and cities that are not just happier, but greener and more sustainable. The Happy City, the low-carbon city, the green city, they're the very same place. And we can all help build that place together.
I've enjoyed this conversation today, Charles. This is a great book, and one could spend all morning talking to you. Thanks for this, and good luck with the book.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to seeing you back in East Van.
Indeed. CharlesMontgomery.ca is the website for more. Also check out thehappycity.com for information on the book and the event Saturday, the 23rd of November, I guess at the Museum of Vancouver. The book is called Happy City, Transforming Our Lives Through Urban Design. It's published by Doubleday. Its author, Charles Montgomery, joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plata.